tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 438 of the Toonami Escape Podcast. I am C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Crocodile.
Hello.
Seda was almost able to make it this week, but unfortunately, he's still behind because of all the stuff he was doing last week. So what we're going to do, we're going to kind of rush through this episode. I want to get as much as I can out of Crocodile before he leaves, and then I'll sort of finish off the episode if necessary. I don't want to miss anything so that we don't have to double up next week. Luckily, there's no news this week that I'm aware of. That just wasn't anything announced at all. So we can skip the news segment and just go right into the block. So let's go into Dragon Ball Daima. Dragon Ball Daima, Episode 10, Ocean. Again, we'll do the quick rundown to keep things brief. Majin Kuu is seen battling Tamagami 1. So they went straight to, I guess, the first demon world and fighting that.
I think that's where they live, Aronsu. I think that's where she's her home base is at.
Oh, I guess that makes sense because she'd probably be near where the king is. Meanwhile, Bulma's team... there's this funny scene where Bulma is like reflecting on the fact that being youthful has given her such wonderful skin now, youthful skin. And then there's like this funny scene where like Hybus kind of hits on her and then Vegeta gets jealous. And then like Hybus is like, I'm willing to share her. That was weird, but funny. We keep then cut back and we get more of the Majin Kuu fight. And it's Majin Kuu's kind of goofy a little bit. He's a little silly in his way he fights.
He's got the boo in him.
I guess you're right. I didn't think about that, but you're right. It must be a little bit of the boo. But yeah, he's not doing too great. Meanwhile, the main core crew have gone through Sir Warp and made it to the second demon world, but they get attacked by gendarmerie planes, which Goku just jumps out and takes them out by flying around. Kind of makes the whole like using a plane thing seem so pointless to me, but whatever.
Well, you have only so much stamina, right? So, like...
That's true, I guess. I never see any of the Z fighters or anybody ever get tired of flying, but I guess it's possible.
And also, Pansy can fly, I think she... But and,
yeah, okay, she so does in everyone, this episode, and I wrote that down. I thought that was weird. I don't know why I thought that was weird.
Everyone can fly, but it's obviously Goku can fly a lot better than everyone else. So, like, there would be kind of, like, trying to get a herd together. You know, you don't want stragglers and everything, so... I think just using a plane is easier.
So the title of this episode is about when they arrive at the second world. There's this huge ocean there, and they get attacked by this kraken. It grabs their ship. Luckily, Pansy rushes in because they forgot to grab the Dragon Ball. But she goes in. It's a very cool scene where you know she kind of very bravely goes and gets it, and Goku kind of rescues her at the last moment. They think they lost it, but they got it, and that's pretty cool. It kind of reminded me of that scene from Akira where they're kind of like getting crushed, you know, and it was like, oh my gosh. But it was...
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Turned out all right. Meanwhile, Goma is watching on a monitor, and he's seeing all this, and he's just really pissed off. And then the main core team head to what was originally the original planet where the Namekians came from. Now, this is confusing to me because it's like, there's a planet nearby, but I thought they were on a planet. I don't really get it.
They're like in spheres of kind of like, I think it's a little bit like a Dyson sphere. Like the demon world is made of multiple spheres. If in those spheres, I think you can have like planets or like continents and stuff like that nature. I think that's how it's generally constructed. So I think someone in Fred remarked on this pretty well, that as soon as he got in the second demon world, that it looked a lot like Namek. And of course, yeah. There was a reason for that, because since the Namekians came here, when they moved to Namek, they basically terraformed the planet to be akin to their old homeworld. So it's not an accident that where the Namekians originally came from looks like Namek, because they made Namek to look like what their old homeworld used to look like. So
right.
And I think we also mentioned that Shin is from here, But in the big lore dump, Shin's also from Second Demon World, but they don't bother to revisit his old place because all his birthing trees, whatever, died, and everyone's basically moved on there, so there's nothing to see. But
after the break, we get more of the Tamagami 1 battle, just continuing. I mean, it all looks great and it's fun, but like the main thing you're getting from this is that the Majin Ku character is just not doing very well. And Aaron Su isn't super pleased by his performance there. Anyway, Goku notices or senses, I guess, the other Z fighters coming. They're getting close, and he goes to warn them about the giant Kraken and ends up saving them. Anyway, they end up meeting up and landing them with them. And there's like this little bit there I just want to mention briefly about, like, everyone's kind of being like, oh, you must feel like you're really home now, Piccolo. And as Piccolo has to keep reminding him, it's like, I've never been to Namek, you know, or I never grew up on Namek.
No, I mean, he was born after they left here. So, like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, this isn't Namek. This is like the thing that Namek's based on, but yeah. So Piccolo's never been here because he was born after they left. So yeah.
Yeah, he's like, I've never been here, but it does feel strangely familiar. I'm sure it's something to do with just his, you know, cultural thing. Anyway, again, we cut back one more time to the Majin Ku fight, but this time Majin Ku just gives up. He surrenders. He just forfeits the fight. And Aaron Su is just, they end up leaving and she's just mad. She's just upset. She's like, you're a real waste. Kind of joking about the fact that like you were supposed to be super powerful and you weren't able to pull it off. And maybe I should just destroy you. And then Ku is like, oh no, I could do all sorts of other things for you. I don't have to be a fighter. I could do your laundry or, you know, other goofy things like that.
I think he mentioned he's a good singer too at some point. Was that earlier or something?
No, he did say that. The two things I remember him saying was that he was a good singer and that he could go, for some reason he said, I could do online shopping for you, which I thought was really out there. But, yeah. Anyway, we learn back with the core teams that the Namekians at some point were often treated as slaves by the other Majin characters.
Just because the Namekians had like powers and so like they were kind of useful. I think the other Majin kind of took advantage of that and whatnot. And I think that's part of the contribution partly contributed to them eventually piecing out. I think my understanding, if I have that all correct.
Yeah, and then we get this really big lore dump that I actually really liked a lot about, where we learn about the like first Demon King, who was like a good guy, and he created, or he knew this person named Rimus. Okay, the Abora, I think, was the original king, and he had someone named Rimus who created the universes. So basically what they're saying here is that like the demon realm existed, but they wanted to expand beyond the demon realm. So they got this guy named Rimus to literally create the multiverse.
My assumption is that Rimus is the ancestor of Zeno, you know, from Super. I'm pretty sure. Like his design was very similar to Zeno. So I'm pretty sure they're like related, like predecessor, ancestor, however you want to call it. But
oh, I need to look at that again. I didn't pick up on that, but that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Basically, this guy created the universes, which is, I just think it's kind of like, wow, okay. I kind of thought it was the other way around or something, but yeah, that's interesting.
And I think they made a point of like how, I wonder if it was Bulma was asking if that means the Saiyans came from here or something of that sort, but I think it was stressed that like, no, that like they created universes and then in those universes, life endemic to those universes popped up separate from the world.
Exactly.
So, like, they're saying, like, not everyone's a Majin or not everyone's descended from Majins, but rather the Majins kind of seeded the multiverse and then life kind of, sui generis arose into those universes on their own and kind of had their own evolutionary path and whatnot.
Yeah. He specifically said, like, Earthlings and Saiyans weren't from the demon realm. They just they came into being on their own, basically. And then the last thing happens that everybody, okay, after this whole like lore dump, they decide, okay, well, it's time to go. They all board the one ship that they have. Which again, it's just silly to me because it's like, why didn't they just do this all along? There was this whole bit about the fact that they couldn't carry that many people. And I get that it's cramped, but like it didn't look that cramped and there was a lot of room in the back.
They lost all the supplies, remember? Because I think issue was that they couldn't fit all the people and all the supplies, but they lost their supplies to the Kraken attack, so it's just them, literally, so.
Fair enough, but, like, then don't take supplies with you, because apparently it doesn't matter anyway.
Well, you do need food and other stuff, right?
Yeah, but like, I don't know. I mean, I think they could get where they're going. I don't know. I have a feeling it's going to turn out to be a moot point. But anyway, we'll see. But as they take off, I think it's the same character. We see an old Namekian come walking up. I think it's that same guy we saw in, like, episode one.
Yeah, it is. Like, I don't, that's not a spoiler. You see a silhouette. You see enough of him to...
Well, I saw his face. I saw his face. I just wasn't 100% sure it was him, but it looked like him. The guy who created the Dragon Balls originally.
I think Neva is his name, is my recollection.
I don't remember.
Regardless, it's definitely him. So that's not a spoiler that it is him. So yeah.
And he's walking up and he just sort of like laughs menacingly. He's like, or like chuckles. So he's going to be up to no good or something. And that's the episode. A lot happens in this episode as far as like finally getting our teams together. And then I like the whole lore dump stuff with the like learning about the greater Dragon Ball universe and how it works. And it's much more, there's a lot, again, I think saying this all along with this show, it's like they feel like Toriyama's really kind of filling in a lot of gaps here just to kind of flesh out how his world works. And I like that stuff. I think it's interesting.
They also did mention the roles of the Glin and how like Supreme Kais came to be. That was an important part of that lore dump and how they sent out to manage universes and whatnot. And you even saw some Kais, not only from that were introduced in Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, Dragon Ball Z, but also some of the Kais introduced in Super as well. Like I remember that yellow Kai who was I think the mentor of Zamasu. You saw him in that bit there.
Yeah, it kind of makes, and now we understand why that they're, like, each of the universes have their Kais now. It's like, that was all part of the plan, which is really interesting. What are your thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I think it was great to finally get the team together. There's some good action. The lore dump is kind of, you know, it's kind of just, like, all thrown at you, but it is, like, if you take time to sift through it, it's actually pretty interesting stuff. So that was all pretty cool. You can see the world of Dragon Ball like expanding and the connections being kind of more fleshed out. And even good humor. Like, I forget the exact context of the conversation you mentioned at the start, but I remember, I think, Haimus had called out Vegeta as a boob man, and then Vegeta was like grumbling, and Piccolo was like, damn, he called you out, son. And it was just, that was pretty funny.
Is pretty funny in general, I'm finding.
His deadpan demeanor works well.
Yeah. One other thing I want to mention, too, is that I am kind of, I mean, I like the idea, or I mean, I don't know if I like it, but it's just interesting how the Majin Ku character turned out to be a nothing. It's just so bucks the trend for what I expect in Dragon Ball, where, like, it's the new big bad, and he turns out to not be, not to be anything.
Well, I think I would say the better way to frame it is that Tamagami number one is actually pretty strong. Like, obviously, like, you know, he's not going to necessarily, like, pair up against Goku well, because Goku's ridiculous, but in the grand scheme of things, the Tamagamis are actually pretty strong, and Tamagami number one is the strongest of the three.
That's fair. And I agree with everything you just said. The other piece of that, though, is, like, the goofiness of him and the fact that he seemed, like, I know that Boo is goofy, but Boo is more like goofy in like a childlike way. And Ku is like, I don't know. He's just kind of like, I don't know how to describe his way, but he's just like more comedic, but on like a straight man level.
No, yeah. Ku has a lot of self-awareness. I think this is actually a plot point that gets stressed upon later. I mean, Ku failed, but he's still in the story. So we'll see plenty of him still. But I think it's pretty well established even here is that he's actually very smart and very self-aware. And that kind of that part of his personality kind of continues to play out as the story progresses. So I think that's a contrast. Like, he's both Ku and Boo are pretty goofy, which makes sense because obviously Ku has Boo in him. But Ku also has a degree of intelligence, self-awareness that Boo didn't even close to having. And I think that's a big distinguishing factor between these two. So, like, yeah. Ku just gave up because, not necessarily because he was a wimp, but it was like...
No, I didn't get that either. I didn't get that. It's just more like the fact that he didn't fight to the death or do something, like, serious. It was more like he played it level and realistic and also right. was like willing to give up. Like, it's just, that's out of left field for me. I wouldn't expect a Dragon Ball villain to just give up. Like, I mean, granted, he tried, but like, it was pretty obvious he was in over his head. But I don't know. Right. The way they're playing this character isn't what I expected at all. It's just interesting.
Of course, now we're going to go through the alphabet and I'm going to find meet up with you next week. So
yeah, I saw the thoughts on that. I saw the preview for the next one. Yeah. All right, let's move on to Dandadan. Dandadan episode 5. Like, where are your balls? These episode titles are pretty great. Quick rundown. I keep wanting to say Okarun. I'm sorry.
Because he's a speedster, I guess. Is
that might be it. Yeah, maybe I'm getting that stuck in my head. Okarun returns to school. There's like a little scene at the beginning where it's like he sees Momo. It's like, are they gonna be nice to each other? Are they not? Momo kind of like, they're both a little uncertain.
Yeah, he's still not sure if they're friends for real or not yet. But Momo, of course, makes that very clear when she kind of, you know, he walks past her, but she's like, "Nah, son, we tight now." So
I like that. I do. That's one thing I really like about Momo's character, is that she's more outgoing than he is, and so she kind of like helps that aspect of their relationship. However, when Okarun separates and goes to his own homeroom, he's immediately bullied. Everyone is picking on him, either deliberately or just by accident. They just don't care that he's there, or they just treat him like he's a nothing. And he's just kind of goes back into his ways of just like trying to focus on his otaku nature and forget about these bullies. Meanwhile, Momo is back with her friend group, and she is kind of in outer space. She's not thinking about school. She just wants to talk about aliens. Now she's like all big on talking about aliens and wants to talk to someone about aliens and wants to talk specifically to Okarun about aliens. That's her big thing. Meanwhile, we cut back to Okarun, and he's just wanting to talk about ghosts. He wants to talk about ghosts. He wants to talk to Momo about ghosts.
Yeah, all they can do is think of each other.
Yeah. Know what that means. Is it really about the topics, or is it about talking to each other? Right. Anyway, when lunch happens, they both go to search for each other, and we get a fun little sequence where they just cannot run into each other. They keep missing each other. They're passing each other in the halls. They don't see each other. They just keep missing. And they end up like outside, sitting on opposite benches, not realizing the other one's 10 feet away. And just thinking about, like, they're just doom thinking about the fact that, like, oh, I guess we really aren't friends, or he dumped me, or like maybe I was too mean to him, or she's too above me, and you know, they can't reconcile it. Get up, start walking without looking, and then just smash into each other, literally almost knocking pissed. Teeth.
Yeah.
And then they kind of have a moment there where they reveal to each other. It's like, oh no, I was looking for you this whole time. And like, they're like, oh, I didn't realize you were looking for me. I was looking for you. And it's like, everything turns out pretty good. But then Momo's two gal pals see them and like, you guys were kissing. And then they both, not just Momo, they both like go full tsundere. And it's like, no, I wasn't. I wouldn't kiss this nerd. And oh, I wouldn't kiss this girl. You know, and they can't admit it for some reason. They don't want to be seen as lovey-dovey. Momo goes back to her classroom, and the other girls in the class are kind of giving her a hard time. They're like, well, why were you hanging around with that dork? Who is that dork? Okarun goes to the bathroom, and then he realizes something's missing.
I would say I would make a pretty big distinction between Momo's direct friends are actually pretty supportive of Okarun, and they're...
Well, I was going to get to that.
Okay, because there's definitely just two friends and then the rest of the group. Yeah, okay.
The larger group are given a hard time, like, oh, you're... Why would you even hang out with that dork and stuff? But her closer friends, yeah, they buck the trend in a moment. But anyway, like I said, Okarun realizes something's wrong, and he goes running to Momo's class, opens the door, And he's like, I need to talk to you right now. And of course, it's like, it's very, very, very important. And all of the like you said, the core friends, the close friends to Momo are like, they're excited about this. They're like, oh, look, he's like, he's going for it. It's like, oh, you go. Four Eyes, you know, they're like cheering him on. And anyway, I don't think it happens in this scene that he reveals that what's happened. He doesn't reveal it yet, right?
No, it's when they're walking down back from school, I think. And then he's like, he's actually finally, oh no, that's, he reveals after the incident of Arya. I feel like
we got to go through that part first. So
yeah, yeah.
So anyway, yeah. They go to leave and, well, wait, what is the deal? It's like, he ends up walking alone.
No, basically Momo pushes him away because she's too soon. So Okorun's like leaves dejected. Then he runs into Arya and then she butters him up and because she's stuck a bitch. It's like, oh, he's in love with me. Oh, I'm the best thing he's ever seen. Then Momo overlooks for Okorun, feeling a little bad that she was too far, overhears a conversation and then drops the proverbial anvil on Arya's head and then walks away with Okorun. And then we get the reveal.
Yeah, so this girl, who, by the way, she hasn't been named yet, but she's like, I know that's who you're talking about. It's the pink-haired girl.
I thought she was named this episode, but maybe I could wrong.
I never heard it.
Oh, I think they said her last name, Shiratori. That's her last name. Maybe they said that.
Maybe, yeah. That sounds familiar, but not her other name. But anyway, yeah, she was kind of like flirting with Okorun, but it wasn't for real. It was just to be like to stroke her ego. And yeah, and she's just, and then when she walks away, Okorun's kind of like, oh, he's really impressed. But then Momo overhears her talking and she's like, oh, that nerd, you know, can't you, he's probably never been that close to a girl in his life and stuff like that. And she gets mad and drops. And like the, whatever that pan was or whatever that she dropped on her head, like it knocked her out. Like she was out cold. And then Momo kind of walks. She's like, come on, Okorun, you're looking cool in those glasses. Let's go home. And then she sort of like under her breath says, it's like some girls will never realize just how cool you are, you know?
Yeah, it was very like, it was me, Austin. It was me all along moment from Momo directed at Arya. So that was pretty funny, but.
Yeah. And I like the way they shot that scene where like when she's like being really nice and like, you know, praising Okorun as they're walking like arm in arm, like her head is like on the right side of the frame and she's all smiling. And then like Okorun's body passes over her face. And then she's looking back on the backside of him now. And you can see her like angry expression. And it's like, it was really well directed. I like that.
Yeah. Momo's defending her turf, you know?
Exactly. Yes. She's like, don't you mess with my four-eyed nerd. Anyway, they make up on the way home. And that's when, like you said, as they're walking home, Okorun explains that his balls are gone. And they make it back to the temple. And Momo is just cracking up, rolling around the floor, laughing at the fact that...
They just cut to the next scene. They don't even walk. They continue walking. They just cut to the next scene. And she's on the floor of, like, busting gut.
Yeah. And then Seiko is, like, immediately, okay, let me look. I need to see. And I mean, she has a reason, we learn, for that. But at this point, you're just kind of like, why? Why do you got to look? And he doesn't want to show her, but.
Well, I think it is a fair question to be like, how the hell do you not notice your balls are missing for like 24 hours, bro?
The answer that they gave in the episode, which is pretty lame, was that like when he noticed that his peen was back, he didn't bother to check any further, which is like, come on, whatever. Anyway, commercial break. We come back and we see that Seiko has got this big paper fan thing and she's like, I'm going to exercise you or whatever. Hits him on the back of the head and this knocks. She says that Turbo Granny is still inside her or still inside him. So she hits Turbo Granny out of Okorun and into this little beckoning cat doll, those like good luck cat doll things.
Yeah, Momo had to help. I think she knocked Granny's consciousness loose, then Momo grabbed it out of Okorun with her like her psychic powers and then transferred into the good luck cat doll, which had like a charm on it, which I guess was probably a conduit for spirits or consciousness to, you know, push the spirit into the doll.
Yeah I don't think the doll is anything special, it's just that's something they had to put her in. Yeah, but yeah, you're right, they used that as a vessel to stick her in there. And then they go chasing it around and they find it in the closet or whatever. And yeah, of course it's Turbo Granny now. And that's why the little, this is the mascot character we've been seeing. Is that this right. is actually Turbo Granny all along in this cat.
It was Momo who traps her in the closet, just to be clear. Like, she runs away, but Momo was able to trap her.
So they confront her, and then I like this bit where they're like, well, you know, how do I get my bald back? And she's like, Turbo Granny has your balls. Well, that's what they insinuate at first. It turns out she doesn't. But at first she does, and she's kind of mocking them and being like, I love that she says, I literally have you by the balls. You have to do what I say or you're never going to get them back. But there's like this bit of like cat and mouse back and forth stuff, no pun intended, about like, I've got control of the situation. No, I've got control of the situation. Anyway, Seiko reveals that, and then suddenly we see that Okaroon can transform and use the powers, which surprises even Turbo Granny. And she's like, what? How can you do that? And Seiko says, well, I only knocked your consciousness out of him. He still has your powers.
Right. So Turbo Granny was all fronting because she thought she got her powers back because it was moving into the body. What happened is that she got separated from her powers. And then while she was making all her bluster, Okaroon got understandably pissed because she was basically, Turbo Granny was asking him to kill the other. So he was like, fuck you, Turbo Granny. And in his anger, he activated powers. And that's when Turbo Granny realized that she was actually not playing a full deck of cards. And so, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great. So there's a lot of like really witty kind of like getting the upper hand on each other. Like, this person's got the upper hand and then the other person has a upper hand. They go back and forth several times. And then Seiko just ends up like chasing Turbo Granny around with the paper thing. She's been calling everyone a rotten tangerine the whole episode, which I don't get that joke. I'm sure there's a cultural thing to that. It's something to do with the TV show. Anyway, ultimately the end of the episode is when Turbo Granny reveals that she actually doesn't know where Okaroon's balls are. They've been lost.
Yeah, Momo makes a deal with Turbo Granny. We give you your powers back, you give Okaroon his balls back. To casually settle down the situation. And then Turbo Granny agrees, but then like, oh, also I have no idea where they are. And then the episode ends.
Yeah, so now they have to go and find them. Yeah, so that's this episode. I'll start out by just saying it's a really great episode. I really struggle to find things about this show I don't like, and this was really well done. I will say, for full disclosure, I had seen the scene before where they bump into each other and like quote unquote kiss. Like, I had seen that somewhere before, so I knew that was coming. But yeah, it was really great. We've kind of got a brief introduction to who is, I'm sure, going to be a recurring character in the future, this pink haired girl.
She's an opening, so you know, like,
yeah, obviously. And there's at least one other character I know, but like her, like, I didn't realize that she was going to be like start out like kind of this way, where she wasn't a nice, I mean, she comes on nice at the beginning, and then you realize she really isn't. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So. That's kind of the funny thing about, for me watching this show, is that this show's so popular that there's little bits I know through cultural osmosis, like certain characters, but I don't know what they're like. And so I didn't realize she was going to be like this. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, great animation, really funny. I genuinely laughed a couple times in this episode. I'm surprised that the cat thing turned out to be Turbo Granny. I didn't expect that. Yeah, really good. What do you think?
So in Dragon Ball, we were looking for the Dragon Balls. In Dandadan, we're looking for Okaroon's balls. You know, just I don't know if we can keep that theme going throughout the night, but it is kind of interesting how we moved from one ball hunt to another ball hunt.
Yeah, that's that kind of Toonami serendipity that happens from time to time.
A block synergy, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really have much more to say other than what you said. Show's fantastic, episode fantastic. I appreciate that, and you'll see this continue out throughout the series, that Momo's friends are actually really supportive. Like, there are lots of series where like the main character or one of the main characters have like the friend group, but the friends are like shitty, worthless characters, are like, why are they even here? I hate them, whatever. And like every friend of theirs that isn't also someone with superpowers is like terrible or worthless or whatever. Momo's friends are just kind of genuine, fun, like, try to make the world and people around them better kind of girls. As like they're not, like, you can contrast them with Arya. Like they're not like in a lot of other shows, they'd be annoying, stuck up bitches or just worthless characters. And I'm not gonna say they're like huge major characters, but they're clearly a positive force on the environment and on the other characters in the relationship. And that's like, that's a good thing to see.
Yeah, there's like two of them that seem to be like the two that we saw that caught them kissing or not really kissing, but you know, this that caught them. Like those two seem to be like cool. And they're like also the two most prominent ones. We've seen them since episode one. There's like,
yeah, those are Momo's main friends. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like the one on the, there's one of them that looks very much like a full on Garu with like the tan skin and everything. And
I'm then
there's
sure like this other girl. Like, yeah.
Oh yeah. She's full on. I mean, she's the dead up, like that's the stereotype of what a Garu would look like, you know, like that's that style. And yeah, they seem cool. Like they've never done anything like that isn't nice. You know what I mean? They're like cool. But there were like, I think there was just a classroom full of girls and many of them in that classroom weren't as cool as them.
Yeah. I wouldn't call those Momo's friends. Those are just like people in her class as opposed to those two girls who are legit her friends.
Exactly. I got that impression. Anything else in this episode you think I need to know or pay closer attention to or anything? I might have missed.
I think, I mean, I already covered the parts where we kind of discussed Momo's contributions later. So I think, we got introduced to some new characters and they're going to obviously be pretty important in the upcoming episodes. So stay tuned.
Yeah, great, great show. This is the highlight of the block for me right now. I look forward to Don to Don more than anything else. All right, let's move on to Bleach. Bleach, 1,000-Year Blood War, Episode 13, The Blade is Me. All right, quick rundown. Ichigo is summoned back to the Soul Society, more specifically back to whatever that place is called.
I think when the sword girls goes to fetch him, right? That's how it happens?
Oh, yeah. I was going to write, I wrote that down. I started in my notes, I started to write down, who is this? And then I immediately remembered, oh, this is like his assistant, that Squad Zero guy's assistant.
Yeah, he has a whole like harem of them and they all have names and different designs and body types and whatnot. And then we never.
Oh, yeah, we learn about a lot of them in this episode. But the main one, the one that we'd seen before, that was her. She grabbed Ichigo and brought him back. He's back in that pit with all those.
Asaugi.
Yeah.
Asauchi, excuse me, and Asauchi,
those like dolls or whatever the proto Zanpakuto. Yeah, it's Bleach. I got to learn these words.
Too many Japanese words.
Yeah, I can't tell if they're Japanese words or they're made up words. I don't know, but
I think they're made up Japanese words is the best way to go about it because you can make up French words, make up English words, and whatnot. So these are clearly like Japanese. But like, you know, putting different things together and, you know, just being flexible with the language.
Yeah. Okay. So, the singing guy who makes the Zanpakutos, he's like, okay, now you can make your blade. And then like, there's this like scene, which is a little over the top for me, but like, Ichigo is now that he knows who he is and he's got, you know, he's got purpose and he's ready to go. He comes walking through all those things, Asauchi's, and they all start like kneeling down to him and stuff, and it's like, oh my god, it's
number one is
protagonist. Back. Yeah. Anyway, he just walks up to one of them and it's you. You're the one, and he grabs him, and it, when he touches it too, you kind of see that hollow version of himself for a second, which ends up being a big deal in a minute. And my note says here, Hitsugaya wants to be trained in the basics. Oh yeah, okay. So we get this little mini montage of all of the other, like, squad captains who've been recently defeated. They're like, okay, some of them have lost their bankai. Some of them don't have them. Or, like, they're...
Never had them, yeah. Like, I like how you said 69 is getting school on bankai, trying to, like, you don't remember his name. Granted, I also do not remember his name, but, like, I don't, like... But
just yeah, the guy with the 69 on his face, yeah.
Because there's so many implications besides, you know, but... Anyway.
Yeah, 69 is getting schooled on how to have a Bankai. Hitsugaya, who's like the short guy, is he goes back to be trained on the basics of sword fighting. We see a couple of other ones. Everyone's just training to get stronger. And we see that one like fox guy who goes to meet with a giant dog.
Yeah, the head of his clan to basically learn some sea technique.
So, okay, quick question here. I don't want to deal too much on this, but I'm just quick question. Like, what's his deal? Like, why does he look like a dog?
Because he is a, he's like half, I think his, I think there, his like, his clan has like animal blood in it or something. Like animal spirit blood, as much blood as a spirit can have, you know, blah, blah, blah. But like, he has like the dog, the large dog he was speaking with is like the head of his clan. His clan has like all those, all his clan mates are like either animals or like furries or, you know, animal human hybrids, whatnot. And so that's just the way his clan is.
Okay.
I don't know. If, I'm sorry if I don't have a better answer for you, but that's just. Like,
it's strange to me because I know we talked a lot last week about how Soul Reapers exist. And this seems sort of out of left field for me where it's like, why is there, why are there animal people? I don't.
Well, there are non-human, like spirits of non-human bodies are pretty common in pretty much all mythologies. So I think it's just, if they're like Soul Reapers are spirits of human forms, it doesn't make it strike me as unusual that there'll be animals, with like spirits of animal forms, and then being this magical world of anime, you can mix them together because Lord knows furries and hybrids or whatnot.
But is he considered a human, or is he just considered a Soul Reaper, or what? Like, what is
he? He's a Soul Reaper with animal and human characteristics.
Okay, fair enough. By the way, the last thing I want to say is that the giant dog thing he talks to looks like Falcor from the movie The Neverending Story. I mean, like, almost exactly the same.
That's fair.
Nice. All right, so we come back from the commercial break, and we get some zany Niamia. I wrote down what these guys are called. So these are all those women that work for the Zero guy. They're called the Niamia bodyguards. And basically in this scene, they're shown doing all sorts of goofy things where they're basically forging the sword, like getting it ready for him to finish it. And so they're like whipping around. And we've got like five of them. They all get like title cards and stuff. And I think someone in the group watch was like, these guys aren't important. I don't know why they're getting so much.
You don't see them again. Like, they all get names and designs and all this shit. Yeah.
Everybody gets an interesting, like, this is like basically Kubo being like, hey, I can design a bunch of characters. Yay.
I mean, I guess it's more fun than just like generic.
Oh, yeah. I don't have a problem with it. I just think it's funny that they never come back. You know, it's just like, okay, we're going to go through this effort to introduce them. And then this is probably the only scene they're going to be in. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not even going to bother to describe them. There were like five of them and they were all different. It's like a short one and a tall one and a big boobied one and another one that's slightly big boobied and, you know, that kind of thing. I did write down too that the guy's I'll never remember his name, but the Zero guy.
Oh, instead of saying Go Ichigo, he calls him Goichi.
Yeah, he calls him Goichi. I didn't realize he had been doing that until this episode because he does it like every, like 10 times in this episode where he's like,
yeah, he did Goichi. In previous episodes too. Yeah.
Yeah, Goichi, what you thinking, Goichi? You know, he just kept saying that. I kind of like it. It is kind of funny. I don't know. Doesn't mind. It's like a funny little quirk he has. Anyway, we learned that he creates a new Zanpakuto for him, but his new Zanpakuto is his hollow. And then there's this whole, like, thing, which I can't describe it. Like, Ichigo goes inside, like, his mind palace or something, and he faces off with Zangetsu, which I think this whole series is he's always assumed Zangetsu was like, you know, his true Zanpakuto, but it turns out Zangetsu was actually this whole time Yuhavaha, this whole time.
Well, he's not Yuhavaha, but rather he's the manifestation of Ichigo's Quincy powers, and because Yuhavaha is the father of all Quincy's, he bears resemblance to Yuhavaha. So he's not him, but he's like similar to him because he's a manifestation of Quincy power, and Quincy powers are derived from Yuhavaha.
So here's a question I have for you. I don't know if you know this. Did Zangetsu through the whole Bleach series have the same voice actor as Yuhavaha?
Yes, they're both Richard Ekpar.
Okay, well, then perfect. Hey, good job then. They kind of made that continuity work.
Well, I mean, it's clear they cast Richard Ekpar as Yuubao later, obviously. Like, they're, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They like followed through, is what I'm saying. Like, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah. It's not so much plan ahead as follow through. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They followed. They didn't get a different voice actor. They made it work by having the same actor, which is good. I like that. Again, this is the Zangetsu thing. Like, that's, I have no memory of that, like, being a thing. Like, I know that he used to go and talk to that guy from time to time, but that's all I know.
Zangetsu has been around since, like, the first arc, or like maybe the second arc. Maybe he was introduced during the Soul Society. But he's been around for a long time, as well as the Hollow from Ichigo, and they've been conversing with him for a long, long time. So there have been frequent encounters between Ichigo, his Hollow, and Zangetsu, or some combination of the two.
Yeah.
In multiple arcs, so.
All right, real quick, I'll finish this up. So Zangetsu explains everything to Ichigo about who he was, who he really was, and what his, you know, what the deal is and everything. And then he leaves, and then there's like a sad thing for Ichigo, because Ichigo's like, I'll never forget you, even though, you know, whatever, I still believe in you and all this stuff. And this is all set over an insert song with vocals and everything during the credits. Like this show likes to do, they like to put the credits in, and then they have more show afterwards. So they continue to do that here, where we see the big reveal that he gets his new Zanpakuto, but it's not just one blade. It's like a big blade and then like a little blade.
I think for Quincy and Hollow, I think, from my understanding.
Yeah, that's what I took it to be, too. Yeah, it's like his new one is probably the big one, and then the littler one is like more representative of his Hollow one that he had before.
Well, they're both new, but there's kind of like two facets of Ichigo being represented here, and they're obviously both different from his old Zanpakuto.
Yes.
It's basically like Zangetsu's being kind of awkward. I'm your, not your ally, but I'm not your enemy, and kind of, but I've always loved you, and so you're like a son to me. And yeah, it was kind of both touching but awkward and kind of, you know, a little whatever. But it got the point across, a big damn heroes moment. Ichigo comes out triumphant. His theme song's blaring in the background. The soundtrack in the series has always been awesome and will continue to be always awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah.
It's all kind of generic shonen fluffery, but it works, and it's good.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. And I like the idea of, like, this is getting Ichigo's character, giving him growth. So I'm cool with that.
Yes.
But we get some more credits, but then after those credits, the final credits, then we get a post-credit scene where we see Yuubao sitting in his throne, and somebody comes walking up, and it's none other than Uru. And then we get this impression that Uru has come to serve him.
Uryu.
I can never say his name. That guy. The Quincy guy from the main cast. Anyway, he doesn't outright say it, but Yuubao is saying that, like, I am glad you've chosen the right side.
I mean, I think he said, welcome, my son, was those his words, right?
Something like that. But I get the impression he's come to picked a side. I don't know if that's true. I honestly, obviously, it can't be because he's the bad guy. But I feel like that's what they're insinuating. So,
I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, what they're insinuating. Like, I don't know how much you want me to say, but like,
yeah, you can go ahead and say it. If you think I should have gotten it, what?
No,
yeah.
So Quincy, so like, Ryu is here because he got a job application for the Stern Ritter. And
that's what I figured. Yeah, that's what I was saying. I was basically saying that. Yes.
Oh, I thought you were doubting. Uri was coming here to fight on behalf of Yuubao.
Oh, no. What I'm doubting is his true allegiance.
Oh, okay. That's fair. All right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, obviously, he got a job application to come to be on the bad guy team. But like, it's that character. He obviously isn't going to be the bad guy in the end. So I'm saying, like, I don't know if he's playing both sides here or if he's conflicted right now. I don't know. But obviously, at the end of the day, this good guy character isn't going to betray his friends forever, I don't think. So,
okay. Yeah, that's all fair. Yeah. And I will say, to be a little bit fair about the episode, I know you've been maybe a little frustrated with the post-credit scene, but like...
Oh, no, I'm not frustrated by it. I'm just pointing it out. I just think it's interesting. Okay. It doesn't bother me at all. I think it's actually kind of cool. I actually think it's kind of cool. I'm just saying that it's interesting that this show does this all the time. Because you get an anime, that's, let's say it's like a 12-episode anime or 24-episode anime, and this will happen once, right?
Like for big moments or something. Yeah.
A big moment or like a big turning point in the series. Like I remember I remember it happened one time in Land of the Lustrous in, when a character died, and it was like a big deal. And so they'll do the post credits song over the credits thing, but this show is like does it every episode.
I feel like I remember Full Metal Alchemist using it pretty frequently, and obviously some shows are more frequent about it than others. But no, I get you. But yeah, it was done differently here, obviously, because they didn't actually cut to anything. The show was still playing; it was just credits rolling over the screen, but the show was still going on. Whereas other episodes, the show actually stopped. But yeah,
you see it in a lot of anime on the last episode of the season, like almost every anime.
I mean, this is actually the last episode of this season. I think.
Oh, you know what it is, isn't it? Oh, I kind of forgot that. Oh, okay.
I think we should be getting a new opening next episode. Yeah.
Well, that makes even more sense.
They didn't say anything, so I assume they're going right into season two. Like, they would have said something. So I'm pretty sure we should be getting a new opening next episode, I think. Yeah, but yeah, this is the end of the first season.
Like, the first core. Because this is all called the Thousand Year Blood Road.
Right. All four. It's a four core series. And three have come out so far.
So my quick thoughts on this episode is like, it was good. I mean, I enjoy this show. I don't enjoy as much as the first two shows on the block, but I like this show. And it's entertaining and fun, and it's interesting. I think it's more about like me catching up with understanding the lore of it. And I do get it, but it's fun and energy and the great animation. And I'm curious to see where it goes. It's pretty good.
Yep. My thoughts mirror your own, except I'm not curious because I already know. But regardless, it's Bleach. It's a superficial show, but it's a good time.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a good time. Yeah, and I would say that like this is more interesting than the Bleach I used to see back on the block in the day. Like this has got my attention more than it did before. I don't know if it's because of the better animation or what, but it just
It's a better adaptation in general. They do a lot of things to improve upon the manga here besides just better art and music. Like they do make some changes to the original manga because Kubo is supervising this whole production, so they made like a lot of changes and they improved upon the final arc a good bunch, because I'm sure you heard a lot of bad things about the final arc, and I think there's still some still here, but they do a lot of work to like change like actually what happens and plot points and writing and whatnot to actually try to improve it a good bit. So it's still not, you know, high tier anime, but it's a lot better than it. Like this is like Kubo's second draft of this arc, and it's a lot better than
used to. Yeah, okay. Well, that makes sense then. I never heard that the last arc was bad. I just heard that this made it better. But knowing that it might have been bad is actually makes me really more impressed, because this has turned out to be pretty good so far. So, all right. Before we continue, do you want to just, are you going to have time to go through?
I do need to head out, so I'll just make a few
comments. Yeah, I'm just going to quickly ask for your quick impressions of these final two episodes.
Basically, for Blue Exorcist, I probably just missed this or like forgot about it, but I didn't realize that Rin and his friends went to normal school. I just thought they went to a school where everyone knew about exorcism and whatnot, so the whole beginning part of the episode was kind of like, they are in normal school? I am very confused, but apparently that's always a thing. B, how the hell did Rin not know Mephisto was a demon? Like, is Rin just stupid? Well, I mean, yes, he is, I guess, but like, come on, dude. Like, Mephisto never hid it at any point from anyone.
That's kind of dumb.
He even showed up as the puppy. Like, he showed up as a puppy in this episode. He's done that before in front of Rin before, I'm pretty sure. So, like, how did Rin not catch that? Rin, you're a stupid idiot. And I guess they're just doing some extra lore that Mephisto is... We always knew he was kind of a big shot, but he was like, oh, I'm actually a Dio, and I have time stop powers. I was like, okay, sure, cool, whatever, bro. Like, maybe help lift a finger next time or something? I don't know. Those were like, oh... Also, Izzy's balls just dropped all of a sudden and he started, like, leading the team. I think I, like, stepped away to get, like, a drink of water for a second and I came back and Izzy just, like, grew 10 years and his balls dropped and were huge. And I was like, what the fuck just happened?
I like that scene.
No, it was pretty cool, but I was just kind of taken aback because I, like, stopped paying attention for, like, a minute. Literally just maybe 60 seconds. And I was just like, what just happened?
Yeah.
So those are my impressions of Blue Exorcist. And for One Piece... Kuros, holy shit, you're fucking stupid. Your own daughter didn't even understand your quote-unquote plan. Luffy has every right to be fucking pissed at Kuros. What a dumb motherfucker. Also, the One Piece populace continues to prove how stupid you are.
Yes.
Oh, Luffy just saved us, but now he's maybe kidnapping a princess. Instead of just asking what's going on, I'm going to assume he's actually a criminal. Come on, One Piece NPCs, fuck off.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, and it's it's even worse this week. So, yeah.
All right. Anyway, I got to head out, but it was nice chatting with you. Have a wonderful night, and I'll see you later.
Okay. See you later. All right. I don't normally do this. I don't do these episodes by myself, but I'm going to go ahead and finish it out here. So let's begin with Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, Episode 1, The World's Astir. Now, I should mention, of course, this is Blue Exorcist, the new season, which is called the Shimane Illuminati arc. And as we had been talking about, this is animated by a new studio. I'm going to go ahead and give my overall impressions of the look of this right out of the gate. And I would say that I'm actually pretty impressed. I think the preview didn't really do it quite the justice, but having now watched this new episode, I thought the animation really did look pretty good. And I may say even a bit step up from what we saw in the previous season. I never thought the previous season looked bad, but this is, I think, a bit of a step up. It looked really good. The character designs are mostly the same, which makes sense. They're both based on the same manga, but I definitely did notice some changes. All of the male characters, just my notice is that they all have a bit more of a square jaw now. Everyone's a little beefier when it comes to the male characters. Everyone looks a little, you know, I don't know how else to put it. They're just more square jawed. And as far as the female characters, they all look pretty much the same, except for Shiemi, who looked very different to me. I think Shiemi looked strikingly different. Not in a bad way, just very different. But overall, the animation quality was really good. Mephisto also looked very different. Again, he's Mephisto. He looked similar, of course, because they're based on the same character design. But I don't know. There's something about the way he's drawn in this where he just seems a little more angular and a little more svelte and just a little less cute, if I can say that. It's just he looked a little more menacing, I guess. So, yeah. I like the new designs, even though they're not a huge departure from what we had, but it is different. And I think the overall animation of the episode was very strong and it looked good. All right, quick rundown of the show. So like Crocodile said, we see Rin in the normal school, which I also kind of completely forgot that he went to normal school. And they even mentioned, I think, in the episode that Rin is actually, you know, the True Cross Academy is like an extracurricular thing or like a second school that he goes to. Anyway, he's in class and another student that sits near him, whose name I didn't write down, starts freaking out because he sees a demon. Rin's thinking to himself, like, oh, that guy must have got his temptate. But then he's like, I don't think that guy did get a temptate. So how can he see demons? This is part of what I think is going to be a bigger plot point. And they kind of allude to this throughout the episode that, humans are starting to see demons and that the worlds are starting to merge together. And this is just an example of that, where a normal person is seeing demons. He gets a letter from Mephisto he gets a letter in his locker and he thinks it's a love letter from a girl, but it turns out it's like a cute looking letter from Mephisto inviting him to a dinner party thing. We also learned that Rin's execution from the Vatican has been postponed. So I guess that's over with. We don't have to worry about that. And then I guess because he did such a good job with the Impure King, I think. And then Rin's walking down the hall and he sees that student, that same student again, getting attacked by a demon this time. And he uses his Son of Satan powers to kind of drive it away. And I think that student sees his tail in that moment. So, yeah, it's like kind of been revealed to that guy, at least, that Rin's also a demon. Because, again, if you can see demons, then you can see Rin's demon powers. Then he goes and he has the banquet with Mephisto. And we get this huge lore dump with Mephisto, which I think is actually really interesting, where Mephisto kind of lays out his plan and explains a bit about himself. He explains that he is actually Samael, also known as the King of Time, or more specifically, the King of Time and Space of Gehenna. So he is the second most powerful demon of Gehenna. And he is the representation of Samael. So he's a big deal. And he kind of teaches, he kind of like, he does like kind of a goofy thing where he like, you know, he's showing, he's revealing to Rin who he is through a kind of goofy little tea party thing. But then he like, he changes it and he makes it all kind of sinister looking, and he starts like using his magic, and he's just like so powerful. Like, it just, the whole scene is to illustrate just how incredibly powerful Mephisto is compared to Rin. And he even like grabs Rin by his tail and like holds him up, and Rin can't do anything. He's just like powerless by the compared to Mephisto. And this is when Mephisto kind of reveals to him that one of the, that demons, their most weakest points are their tail and their hearts. Their hearts, that if their hearts are swayed or hurt, that they are, you know, that's, they're very vulnerable. And likewise, if you get a hold of a demon's tail, they're also very vulnerable there. And he kind of, Mephisto talks about how like, when every time he looks at Rin, he just feels like he's embarrassed. He's embarrassed by, maybe not embarrassed, but he thinks Rin is embarrassing because he's terrible at hiding his tail, because real demons never show their tails. It's a weakness. And then Rin also wears his heart on his sleeve, which is another huge weakness. So he's just kind of schooling Rin all about demons and stuff. And he basically says that his whole plan, well, you know, I don't really quite remember his plan. He did talk a little bit about it here. I should have wrote that down, but it was something about like, I don't really remember now. I don't want to speculate, but he kind of hinted to what his plan was in that scene. We come back from the commercial break. Izumo is, and the other classmates are kind of outside the school, and they see a cute little puppy walking up. I actually completely forgot that Mephisto could do this. I don't remember this little, I mean, I remember seeing that puppy before and being like, oh, it's that dog again. What's that? And then it turned into Mephisto and it freaked out Izumo. Anyway, he's there and he's like, okay, class, come with me. I've got a test for you. And they go into this big room and there are all these paintings on the walls. And there's this demon, and he points to this one painting. And it's like, this is a demon, and it's called the Family Portrait. And this is your test. You have to defeat it, but it's going to require you work together. And then this leads sort of into what Crocodile was mentioning about Kona Kamaru, I think is his name. The glasses kid. He gets like a big scene in this moment where everyone's kind of like doing their thing. Like Rin wants to just attack. Bond's putting up his shield. Everyone's doing their thing, but they're not coordinating at all. And he realizes that he is the strategic person, and he calls everyone out on their flaws in a really cool way. Like he gets his courage, and he's like, I'm going to tell you what your problem is. I'm going to tell you what your problem is. You need to stop doing this. You need to stop doing that. You need to do this. And you need to do that. And if we do these things and you coordinate with me and do what I say, we will defeat this thing. And that's basically what happens. He grills everyone on their weaknesses. They reveal that the Family Portrait is a shapeshifter style demon. And they start working together through him, basically coordinating them. And that's when they're able to kind of turn the tide of the battle. They realize that the trick of this whole thing is that one painting isn't the only painting. It's the only piece of the demon. There are these four or five other paintings on the walls that are all connected, that constitute the family. And they have to defeat all of those simultaneously. And so they coordinate and defeat them simultaneously, and they win. By the way, I forgot to mention this. The whole point of doing this test was that Mephisto said that he could help Rin help that other no-name student. Well, I think he had a name, but the normal human stop seeing demons if he gave him these magical eye drops. But he said he would only give them that magical eye drops if they defeated this Family Portrait demon. So they do. So they end up getting the eye drops that he ends up giving to the kid, that I think that's going to help them stop seeing the demons. But there was a sort of almost pre-credit sequence right before the credits where we meet these two other characters. One of them is named Lightning, and I don't know what the other one was. And they mentioned something about angels, and they were just fighting something in a desert, like a demon. And the demon's like, the world is coming to an end, or something like that. And it was like a big deal. And I think these are two new characters. Maybe they're part of the Illuminati. I don't know. But yeah, Two important new characters introduced early on, and we'll no doubt learn more about them in the future. One of them kind of gave me like Ace vibes from One Piece, but I don't know. So that's the first episode of Blue Exorcist, the new season. I thought it was really entertaining. I liked it. I think they did a lot to forward the plot and not just like the plot of the season. It feels like we're forwarding the plot of the show. Like the big plot is moving forward now. And I think someone mentioned that in the thread, that that's something these next two seasons kind of do, is they push the overall story of Blue Exorcist forward. There was also a scene in this episode between Rin and Yukio. I mean, it's kind of an important scene insofar that they're kind of like, you know, Yukio's acting a little strange, and Rin realizes that. And it's just an extension of what we've been seeing, where they're like, you know, Yukio's uncertain. He's in an uncertain place right now. And Rin is trying to be like a helpful older brother. And of course, Rin is kind of a goofball, so it doesn't work really well. But yeah. Overall, really good. I'm happy to see that the new season looks great. I'm sure these tweaked character designs will completely grow on me. And like I said, the only character that really seemed odd to me was Shiemi. There were shots of Shiemi in this episode where I felt like she looked off model. But then I thought, well, that's probably just what she looks like now. So it's just what it is. So pretty good. All right, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the final episode. So let's move on to One Piece. One Piece episode 741, A State of Emergency. Rebecca is kidnapped. I'll tell you what, this is going to be quick because ain't a whole lot happened in this episode. This is peak One Piece fillerish stuff. It's not true filler, but boy, does it feel like it, because not a lot happens. I only have like four notes here. Bartolomeo is with the others at Kiros' place. And he's basically explaining to them that he and the other arena fighters / pirates have been stationed all along a route that's going to lead the Straw Hats and Law safely to a ship so that they can escape Dressrosa. The Marines are on the move. And I actually kind of forgot that they didn't have a ship when he said that. I'm like, wait, they're not going back to the Thousand Sunny? And I'm like, oh, no, wait, they can't. Because that's where everyone else is. So, yeah, I guess they have a ship waiting for them. So they all start running, and then we get this like exciting scene where they're being chased by Marines and stuff. And the other Colosseum fighters / pirates are sort of protecting them as they go. Barto is putting up his barrier and everything. But Luffy, who's been giving Kiros, rightfully so, a really angry look this whole time, decides to go in the opposite direction. He's going to head, and rather than going to the coast, he's heading towards the castle, the palace or whatever. We come back from this, and that's pretty much that part of the episode. We come back from the commercial break. Luffy fights his way up the side of the hill all the way to the palace, and he reaches Rebecca, and he's super angry, and he's yelling. He's not mad at her, but he's just really mad. And he's asking her, is like, are you okay with what Kiros is doing? And she's like, but he wrote me this note. And, you know, I understand. And he's like, don't do what he says. And I guess he's kind of speaking for the audience here. And he's like, do you want to do this or you want to leave? You can come with me. And she's like, okay. And then he grabs her and then takes her. And this is what Crocodile was alluding to a moment ago, too, which is really frustrating, where it's like, the citizens of Dressrosa and most ordinary people in the world of One Piece who aren't named characters, like, they have like the memories of goldfish. He takes Rebecca, and instead of people like going, oh my God, look, it's the savior of Dressrosa, Lucy, and he's with Rebecca, our princess. Look at, they're flying through the air. He's going to protect her. Instead of saying that, they're all like, look at that damn pirate, Luffy. He's stealing our princess. And it's like, what? You guys make up your damn minds. You like this guy? Do you hate this guy? It's really stupid. It's dumb. Everyone's mad at him. I mean, except for like the people who know Luffy, but like all the ordinary people, Kiros, he believes in him, I guess, but like normal everyday citizens are like, you damn pirate. And it's just dumb. Anyway, as they're flying through the air, suddenly a whole bunch of Marines go to shoot their muskets. But then like when they pull the triggers, no bullets come out or something, like nothing happens. And then all of them just start falling to the ground. And I think, is it Isho? Or maybe it was, it was Sentamaru or somebody who's like, not Sentamaru, that's the wrong guy. Anyway, the former fleet admiral, he's like looking at it, is this Conqueror's Haki? And he's like, no, it's not Conqueror's Haki. They're all just sort of, they just fell over and they're just sort of getting back up. They're not knocked out. So it's kind of like, what happened here? It's not clear what's going on. All the Marines are kind of getting knocked out, but it's not Conqueror's Haki. So something's going on, and it's not alluded to what exactly it is. And the episode basically just ends with Luffy and Rebecca flying at the screen with her on his back. And that's it. Not a particularly good episode of One Piece. I like to see a little Bartolomeo, but it's pretty generic. Luffy. I think Luffy's doing something good here, but he's doing it in like a childish way, which is, I guess, typical of him. I just want to say really quickly, too, that I rewatched a bunch of reactions to the One Piece live action. And maybe this is heretical for me to say, but Inaki, I think, is the actor's name, the guy who plays Luffy in the live action. I realize now that I actually like the live action Luffy way more than I like the anime Luffy, like way more, probably more than the manga version. He's just more charismatic and likable than what we're getting here, where he's doing good and he's a good guy and he fights for his friends and all that stuff, but he's also frustrating. And in this edition, and I think the live action version is just way better. And I mean, I don't know, that's probably, you know, pitchfork thing for me to say, but I really do feel that way. I enjoy the live action Luffy more than this. Anyway, I mean, I agree that what he's doing is probably good, but he just deals about it in such a way that's like just asks for trouble in a way that I don't know. I can't, whatever. It's Luffy. But yeah, overall, this episode just feels like we're kind of like running on fumes now with Dressrosa content. It's like, just come on, get this over with. Resolve the issue so we can leave. I want to go on to the next arc, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, but we're getting closer. So that's basically it. That's One Piece for this week. Since I'm by myself, I'm not going to bother to try to do any flavor alerts. I'll ask the guys next week, maybe when we come back, if they had anything from this week they thought was particularly award-worthy. But I, off the top of my head, can't think of anything that I was super impressed by. Good moments in this week, particularly with Don to Don, but nothing that I thought was like, got to write that down. So having said that, I think I'll go ahead and end this episode. I want to thank Crocodile for being here for the first part of the episode. And, and I look forward to hopefully having Seda back next week. He's basically, we did talk to him briefly right before we started recording. And he basically was like, he finally got to the point that he was done with all his Gamescom stuff, but now he's behind on the block. He hasn't seen the episodes, so he can't really talk about them. So we'll look forward to seeing that then, and until next week, later.